tonight to share their experience, strength, and hope, we have John from the Carol Second Chance Group.
I've been told it's okay to stand up. So it works. My name is John G., and I'm a grateful alcoholic.
Thanks, John.
Hello, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving holiday to everyone. And my mother died about a little over 4 years ago, and she kept everything. I'm the oldest of seven, Irish Catholic family, and she kept everything. It took me, my brothers and sisters and I, days and days, weeks to clean out the house. And people took what they want, and I got the rest. And it's all upstairs in a room. And just the way I'm going to start, one of the things, she kept report cards from kindergarten through college for every one of us. Photos, duplicates of photos, thousands and thousands of photos. It's been a real full-time job. But anyhow, I'm going to start with my kindergarten report card. This is Carol Durham Kindergarten. The teacher was Mrs. Jones. And there's only two semesters here. And this is a real surprise when I saw this. The first semester, the teacher said, John gets along well with the other children and takes great joy in accomplishing what is expected of him. And my father signed that. The second semester, as John has gotten over his shyness, he has become quite fresh. However, I feel this in some way has to do with the new baby coming in. My mother was having another baby. And perhaps summer home will help a lot. He will make a nice little first grader. You know, and that brought me back because, you know, I'm not literally a really people person even then. And, you know, I had even control issues in school. You know, we all in some way or another have a loneliness or an emptiness inside. And the second semester there, they had like a nap time every day in kindergarten. They'd give you like a candy. It was supposed to be a sleeping pill, whatever. But this one Sunday after the nap, or this one day after the nap, we'd all go out in the yard, the playground. And the teacher made a specific demand that, okay, when you go outside, you got to, because something else was going on, you had to go over to the bleachers, no playground. Well, I totally ignored that. When we went outside, I did what I normally do. I went right for the monkey bars, you know, climbing up. And she got me down, you know, by the ear, took me back into the school, and she brought me to the first grade class. And they were all looking at me as we walked in, and she opened the door to the closet where the vacuum cleaner and the brooms and stuff were, and put me in there and shut the door. And you know, you couldn't do that today, but back then. But unfortunately, she forgot about that I was in there, and I fell asleep. I was in there for hours, and I came out, you know. But that just shows the, you know, the type of stuff that was happening. But moving right along, my mother was a disciplinarian of the house. You know, she was a seamstress from the city. My father and her were from the Bronx. She was the disciplinarian. My father, all he had to do was look at you and you straightened right out. Never got hit. None of the kids ever got hit by my father or anything. But my mother, on the other hand, because she was a disciplinarian and she was a seamstress, she made an actual cat of nine tails. She got a little broomstick and had nine leather straps that she took. And whenever we weren't doing something she wants, she didn't really hit us, but she would bring that thing out and start shaking it. And we did what she told us, you know. I think she hit my brother Timothy's legs one time, but that was it. And moving right along, when I was 14, I got my first job at Pickwick Lodge up in Round Top. I was a pot washer. And the dishwasher, his name was Stoltz. He was from Germany. And he looked ancient to me because he had white hair, but he was really probably only in the late 40s, early 50s. And after breakfast every day, he would say, "John, go into the bar and get me a bottle of German beer, you know, St. Pauli Girl, Löwenbräu, Dinkel, whatever it was," and I would do that, and he would finish the dishes. And he was kind of cool. I liked him because every morning he'd take a piece of cardboard and a magic marker and he'd write a different phrase in German. By the end of the summer, I could speak like conversational German. And every once in a while, he'd throw in dirty words to keep my interest. And then one day, he's, "John, go into the bar and get me a bottle of beer and get one for yourself." 14 years old. My mother and father used to have parties at the house, but, you know, drinking and smoking, but, you know, I never touched anything there. So I got myself a beer. So here's a 14-year-old kid, 9:30 in the morning, drinking beer, and I liked it. You know, it didn't take control of me, but I got that buzz where occasionally I would think back to that. You know, I didn't obsess over it, but I liked that feeling. And through my years working up there, the second year I was the coffee boy, then I was a waiter, and then the last year, because the drinking age was 18, I hit the top of the pyramid. I was the bartender. And, you know, it was a lot of fun. Didn't really get in a lot of trouble, but I could drink in all the bars in the area. Like from 15 years old, I was going to all the bars and drinking. And, you know, went to the Woodstock Festival, all that stuff in 1969. And no real trouble, though. And when I graduated high school, I followed my girlfriend to the college she was going to, which was Hudson Valley Community College. And she pledged this sorority, so naturally I pledged the fraternity that was linked to them somehow. And I got a basketball scholarship because I was pretty good at basketball. And I think I made it, because I joined this fraternity, I think I made two or three practices. Well, that was the end of my basketball career. And then three semesters as a full-time student, I salvaged 15 credit hours. I was drinking and partying all of the time. At Hudson Valley, each building had a letter, A, B, C, D, and they all designated a different building, a different discipline. And then there was another building across the street. It was called the Grove. We all referred to it as the G building. And we would go there to drink. So anyhow, I lost my student deferment because your birthday took on a new meaning back then. You were assigned a number depending on what your birthday. And if it was like 150 or less, you were going to Vietnam, you were going to get drafted. Or if you were above, you were okay. I had a student deferment. Well, I lost my student deferment. I got the letter from Uncle Sam. And it basically said, "We want you." And I'm thinking, "I don't want you." And you know, because that was not a popular war. So I went down the next day and enlisted in the Navy. And so I was in the Navy, going right along here. And you know, they have the saying in AA, if you're in a room like this, and you don't know anybody in a room, and there's only two alcoholics, you'll find that person. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened with me in the Navy. You know, I found these guys, Philadelphia, different places they were from, North Carolina. And on weekends, we'd go on Liberty, and we would go to these bars and always get back a little late. So really, officially, you're AWOL. But anyhow, long story short, these guys had a plan, unbeknownst to me. And then one day, I got called in by NIS, which is Naval Investigative Service. And they sat each of us down. I didn't know, but they must have thought like they did. So they gave me a choice. They say, "You can go to this program here on base." I was in radio on Morse Code School. "Or we can give you a general discharge under honorable conditions," which is what I took. And I got home and I started working right away. You know, I was like, I don't know if you call me a high-level drunk, but I always worked constantly, paid my bills, you know, didn't really get in any trouble. And I met this woman, and we ended up getting married. I was doing the responsible thing, actually, and it wasn't meant to be. And we broke up after, like, I don't know, 8 or 9 years, and then I was really free to drink the way I wanted. So at work, things progressed very, very quickly. I could talk to people, I could be social, but I really didn't feel a part of, and I think in a little way we all feel that way, that emptiness inside. And I was a bar drinker. I really didn't drink at home. I drank at bars. I'd go from bar to bar to bar. And now in sobriety, I realize a lot of that was because I didn't really want to know any, I didn't want people to really get to know me. I could be social and laugh and have fun in that, but you know, I couldn't do it without the drink. And I ran into some situations. You know, I met another girl, and we started dating, we started living together, and my drinking continued, and I would get into these situations. Like when I was at where I worked there for a CPA firm for 10 years, and I worked in the finance department of the hospital for like 30 years. It got to the point where when I would leave work, I would do things like crazy to control my drinking. I joined the Elks Club in Cats in Hudson, and eventually they had a beautiful bar downstairs, a sauna, bowling alleys, and I said, well, they needed a treasurer. So I said, okay, well, when I leave work, I'll go there. I'll do the payroll, pay the bills, all that stuff at the Hudson Elks Club. and that would keep me from drinking the way I normally do. But that didn't work. All it meant was I stayed out later to get the buzz. You know, I'd drink there, hit all the bars on the way home. I used to have the crazy thought towards the end that, because I lived in Greene County, I lived here in Cairo, up in Pearling, and so I had to cross the bridge. So what I would do is when I would start crossing the Rip Van Winkle Bridge, I would say to myself, when I get across the bridge, if the light's green, I'm going to go right home. If it's red, I'm going to stop and have a drink. Well, I timed it. That life was never green. You know, now I look back at the insanity of where the direction I was going in. And I have a very dry, sarcastic sense of humor, and no matter who it is. And I remember I was drinking at the Lord's house. If I wanted to see my father, I had to go to a bar, because he was a bar drinker too. So I'd have these paths. I'd take different routes home. Matter of fact, Pat's brother was one of my favorite bartenders at Hoppano's. I stopped at the Lawrence house, and on the way home, I had this old truck. They referred to it as the Sanford Mobile. They'd always say, hey, where's Lamont? You know, this thing was a wreck. But anyhow, troopers pulled me over. I was almost home, like a mile and a half from home, and they pulled me over. They must have saw the truck pull out of the bar. I rolled down the window, and you know, the name, the license, all that. And they said, can you recite the alphabet for me? I'm thinking, oh my God, I always get stuck at that L-M-N-O-P part. So I started to sing it like I was in kindergarten. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H. And they said, okay, out of the truck. So I get out, and then they make me walk the line, and I did fine, and they followed me home. This type of stuff happened because I knew everybody, and back then the laws weren't as stringent. I get right to the meat of the matter. At the end of my drinking, I was getting a little crazy when I drank. I got in a fight with this guy at this place in South Carolina. So we had a fight, and when it was over, I just went back to the bar and started drinking like nothing happened. And somebody must have called the cops, because the troopers came to the bar, and they took me outside, frisked me and stuff like that. So found a little bit of dry goods, but that's neither here nor there. So I ended up in cuffs in the troopers' barracks. And once again, the troopers are questioning me in this room, and a guy that my father knew, who was a BCI, he saw me in there. So he said, "You guys take off, I'll take care of this one." And he reduced the charges, he followed me home. They called my mother, and and once again, I got away with, a lot. And because they called my mother stopped at the house. She wanted me to stay that night with her. She thought I was gonna commit suicide. I had no thought of suicide. When you're dead, you can't drink. So why would I do that, But, the next morning, I went to my mother's house to let her know everything's okay. And I'm sitting on the couch, with my head in my hands, and she's doing her knitting or sewing or whatever. And I said, Mom, I think I'm an alcoholic. She got up, stopped what she was doing, and she said, I prayed for your father to stop drinking for 25 years, and he never did. But in a way, my prayers were answered. You're the first one in the family to admit you have a problem with alcohol. And we hugged, we shed tears. She took me to my next meeting, my first meeting the next night, which was the Caro Second Chance Group, when it was at the Lutheran Church. And when I walked in the door, there were three or four guys I used to drink with in the bar, and I always wondered what happened to them, and there they were. And one of them was, the second meeting I went to the original Greenville group, I walked in there, and there was George O. And I used to drink in his bar, we used to party together, and that old saying, when I walked in, he goes, "Here, John, I've been saving a seat for you." How that is. And I didn't ask George to be my sponsor. He made me his sponsor. He knew about me, a lot about me already. And then I continued my journey on. I voluntarily went to Twin Counties and started going to meetings, even though I had to have the sheet signed. It didn't matter, but the program of Alcoholics Anonymous didn't really get me. It was the fellowship. It was very mysterious what happens in these rooms with the fellowship. It was like being in a bar with no alcohol. People laughing, joking around, helping one another. But I really came to get my girlfriend back, to be honest about it. And I was thinking, she's watching every move I make, haha. When I celebrate a year, she's gonna walk through the door, and we're gonna live happily ever after. That never happened either. When I was celebrating, by the time I was celebrating my first anniversary, I really didn't care whether she walked through the door or not, because I had gotten something back far more important, and that was myself. My self-respect, my dignity, so on and so forth. And it was really funny. The things that I remember from the early days, people call them old-timers. The guy in a second chance group wanted to be called long-timers. They didn't want to be called old-timers. And, one of the things that kind of irked me was whenever a topic would come out, the same guys would say the same things, have the same response for every topic. Mike knows. And like if it was gratitude, Dan Fitzgerald would say, if you're not grateful for what you do have, and if you feel sorry for what you don't have, you'll go back to what you did have. And he used to talk about going to a meeting in the city, and when you go down the cellar, there would be a picture on the wall of ships in the harbor, and the writing on the bottom of the picture said, ships safe in harbor, but that's not what ships were built for. And he made that analogy to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that, you know, we're here not to become safe and protected, we're here to help one another, you know, and things like that. And it was tough for my family. My brothers and I, we used to drink a lot, and they don't understand, they still, to this day, think it's a matter of willpower. My mother died like 4 years ago, and we just buried her a couple of years ago, had a service and that. And at the bar up at the Red Rooster, we had, you know, the priest there and different people. And I went up to the bar to get my to get a soda. And my brother was there, and he was, they still think it's willpower. He said, he ordered a shot and a beer, and he said, you want to have a drink, John? After all these years in the fellowship, he's asking me that question. And I said, no, I'm not going to have, I just want my cranberry and club soda. And he said to me, you mean you won't have a drink for your dead mother? And I'm thinking, oh boy, you know, they just don't get it. You know, it's really, really sad. Shortly after I got sober, I remember I was in, what's Hannaford now, it used to be Great American. I used to take my mother to doctor's appointments and shopping and so forth. And we were checking out in the line, and I'm packing the groceries in a bag. And my mother knew a few people that were standing behind her. She was so proud that I stopped drinking and everything. She was telling these people that, this is my son John. He doesn't drink anymore. He goes to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going, Mom, that's the second, you know, it's anonymous. Only I can break my up. But she was so proud that she broke out doing that. And, I have a few years in a fellowship, but, you know, like they say, the sayings in AA, we only have today, one day at a time. That's all we have. And Alcoholics Anonymous is the most spiritual program that I've ever belonged to. Not to this church or any religion, but as far as spirituality goes, this is it. I mean, when people walk through that door, they drop their politics, their religion, all the, you know, political choices at the threshold. And we come in here and we can get along and help one another. And it's a wonderful fellowship. I'm proud to be a member of it. And the more of us that are in here, the better it's going to be out in that insane world out there. Thank you.